Welcome, folks, to another edition of Smith and Jones. Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you, and we are right in the heat, in the heart of the NBA Finals, and we're going to jump into that in just a couple of moments, but a quick reminder off the top, of course, to subscribe to Smith and Jones wherever you get your podcast. Download, subscribe, rate, review, and share with fresh content every Thursday on your favorite podcast platform and on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and Jonesy. It is now 2-1 Nuggets, at least at the time that we are doing this show, and I have to say, and I don't want to misrepresent you by any means, so feel free to defend yourself if needed, but you have been one of the more vocal critics of Nikola Jokic over the years because of the fact that he does kind of tend to play only one end of the floor. But that one end that he plays, man, he is unbelievable to watch with what he can do at his size as a scorer, as a passer, as a rebounder, as a facilitator, his sense on the floor, his smarts on the floor. And when you combine that with the level at which Jamal Murray is playing right now, that team, the Nuggets, is an absolute thrill to watch right now.
Yeah, you get no argument on the offensive end from me about Jokic. As a matter of fact, I will be as boisterous in my praise, as effusive in my praise for his offense as I am for his lackluster defense. The guy's brilliant on the offensive end. He really is. He's simple. He's fundamental. He always makes the right play. And he never forgets the fact that he's 7 foot and, you know, has the weight of a small truck. Because there are times when they switch on him and it's slow and it's plodding and he backs his way down and it's like you might as well put one of those slow red triangles on the back that beeps when a vehicle's backing up, because he gets to he doesn't forget he's 7 feet. He gets into the lane and he scores on you, and he's got a marvelous touch and an array of off balance one footers and leaners that a guard would have. Like he's a guard in a 7 foot body that uses the 7 foot body when he has to, all on the offensive end. I mean, defensively, when Miami went at him in game two, in that fourth quarter, you know, people talked about the confusion on the pin downs and stuff. Well, Jokic was the guy that was either A, supposed to be pressuring the ball and wasn't close enough, or B, standing in the lane trying to help and was out of position. But then again, I can name a number of MVPs that it's up for debate. How much do guys impact the game on the defensive end? Steve Nash, Steph Curry. Like, there's lots of guys like that. So I'm not decrying his value. He's terrific. He's the reason why they're winning. And then you put that with Jamal Murray, who was magnificent in game three, and a guy that when you have that in addition to Jokic, there's no way you can take away everything. And Miami scores 93 points in game one, they lose. They score 94 points in game three, they lose. It's the lowest scoring team in the NBA regular season. And, you know, with Jokic and Murray doing their thing, I'm not surprised that the count is 2-1 as we record this.
Yeah. And you know what, Jonesy, for the depth that the Heat have, I love the depth that the Nuggets have. What's the line I've used for so many years that we've talked about? They just seem to me to have more players on their team that know their role, but more importantly, accept their role. And they just fit in seamlessly behind Jokic and Murray. And they're as important at times for stretches. Like, you know, without Brown and Brown, with the two of them and what they've been doing, without Green, without Gordon, like each individual, like heck, even in game three, I thought Aaron Gordon had a hell of a game, but it was overshadowed, rightfully so, by the respective triple doubles from both Murray and Jokic. But they've just played so well as a cohesive unit. Again, at the time we're chatting, it's 2-1. I don't see how Miami comes back right now and ultimately, you know, holds Denver away from winning this thing. I'm not saying it's over in five. I picked Denver in six at the beginning. I just don't see how Miami is going to be able to win three of the next four in order to hold off Denver from winning the title.
Well, they won game two by taking away the guys that help Jokic. He still had a monster game. And Eric, you've heard me say this before, the same way I love your line about guys not only playing a role, but accepting a role, being given a role and accepting it. You know, my line is always, and you've heard me say this before, it's not the guy that gives me 30 points that I'm afraid of. It's the guy that gives me 20 points and like 12 assists, because now you got everybody to stop. And that's what happened in game two. The Heat, you know, and Eric Spoelstra bristled at the fact that somebody asked him, I think it was one of our colleagues, Ramona Shelburne, asked him about, oh, you made Jokic a scorer. Well, he didn't want to admit it, but that's what happened. They concentrated on taking away all the other guys, and they were able to hold on to Jamal Murray, and bang, they get a win. How are they going to be able to do that the next time? Because with the confidence that Jamal Murray's playing with, and Christian Brown and Bruce Brown and KCP and Aaron Gordon, it's tough to take all those guys away. So good luck to Miami. The other thing I think Miami's going to have to do is just make some shots. Like for a team that is the lowest scoring team in the NBA, they actually put up, I think they had 90 shots or 92 shots in game three, and they didn't make them. And, you know, give Denver's defense some credit, but if Miami, your personality, you are what you are. I mean, they're the lowest scoring team in the NBA, and if they're not making shots, they're going to be stuck in the 90s, and that ain't getting it done.
Yeah, I hear you. And you know, maybe it's all catching up with the Heat right now. Like, Jimmy Butler has not looked 100% either, and that's had a massive impact, right? Like, because he I'm not going to say he carried him alone, but he was the catalyst through the first three rounds. But here in the finals, he has not been the same type of player, at least not had the same type of impact that we saw in the conference final or in rounds one or two, right?
Totally agree, Eric. He's a guy that, you know, what do we always say? In the biggest games, your best players need to be your best players. And Jimmy Butler has, you know, Jimmy Butler has come up short. And you wonder if it's a fatigue factor. You really, really do. But at the same time, they need all hands on deck. I mean, Bam Adebayo was great in the first half of game three, and then he was 2 of 9 in the second half. So, you know, your best players have to come through. And if you're Miami, you need all those. You can't always depend on, you know, Caleb Martin. Where has he been after having a spectacular conference finals? He's, dare I say, he's gone back to being Caleb Martin, you know. Gabe Vincent, Max Strus, all of these guys that, you know, played really well, have been relatively quiet. And not all of that is Denver's defense. So Miami needs to step forward, especially their better players.
All right, let's keep this conversation going and get into it with a guy that has become a friend of the show. He's been a friend of the show for a long time. Former Raptors assistant coach, of course, longtime NBA head coach, and calling the NBA Finals on the radio side with Doris Burke and Mark Kestisher. Welcome back to the show, PJ Carlissimo.
PJ, I want you to put your coaching hat on for me. And what do you do with Nikola Jokic? Like, you know, we always say that it's not the guy that scores 30. It's the guy that scores 20 and has 10 assists. And this guy is doing that, and he's rebounding too. Like, what do you do to stop him? What did the Heat do well in game two? And they couldn't do it again in game three.
I'm not taking anything away from Spo and his team, the way they played in game two. But I do think it was less what they did than it was Nikola's teammates. I just think that they didn't give him the kind of help, including Jamal, in game two that they did in game three. And I think it was as simple as that. I think it was good. They tried to stay home on the perimeter guys as much as they could. But they put the ball in the basket, which was probably the biggest difference. And so that slowed Denver down, which is more to Miami's liking. And the other thing it allowed Spo to do, particularly in the second half of game two, was to change defenses. I mean, they just missed so many shots in game one until they were down 20 late they made a legit run, but they really weren't back in the game. In game two, A, they got to the foul line, which, I mean, it was impossible not to get there more than they did in game one. I mean, he set an NBA record for fewest free throws in a playoff game in game one. But because there were so few free throws and because they didn't shoot it well for most of game one, they never got a chance to put the press on, go back to the press to the zone, just the zone, man-to-man, mix it up. There were possessions where there was an out-of-bounds play, you know, the ball got knocked out of bounds in the middle of the possession, and he'd switch from one to the other. He was able to keep them off balance a lot more in game two because they shot the ball better. Now, they did everything better, but they also defended the perimeter guys. I mean, Michael Porter Jr. is just having a horrendous series so far. He missed open shot. He was like, I think he's 3 for 17 now, or 3 for 18. I don't know how many he missed. Missed two last night. He might be 3 for 19 right now. KCP had a very atypical game. First of all, he had a lot of bad fouls. I mean, he's a veteran player, and he's usually really smart. I still can't figure out why the Lakers had to move him. It must have been some salary cap or whatever the hell. Because, I mean, I thought he was a really good player for them when they won the championship in the bubble. He fouled. He was responsible for 11 made free throws by Miami in that game. And they just had a ton of breakdowns, and it led to Miami shooting a good percentage, them not being able to run because they weren't running off misses the way they did in game one. And they were able to, you know, stay home on Nikola. He doesn't like to shoot it as much as he likes to pass it. But if it's a game when they're just struggling to score, which was what game two was, then he goes more. Everybody says, well, you know, every time he gets 40, they lose. Well, it's true. They're 0-3. But it's really more a function of he didn't have help. He doesn't take that many shots unless other guys are not stepping up. And Jamal, by his standards, had a subpar game in game two. He still played well, but you look at the stats and you take away that little final run when they went on like that 12-3 run after they fell behind by 12, and then they almost, you know, they got it to the last shot of the game. Jamal had a quiet game. Last night, from the very first possession, Jamal was aggressive. He was taking the ball to the basket. He was looking to score. He was even more aggressive on the defensive end. And Nikola was looking to pass again, even though he was scoring. And he had help. Aaron Gordon played really well. Christian Brown played out of his mind. He played fantastic. So I just think he had a lot more help in game three. But Michael Malone, as he just told us, we just finished up the interviews. First thing he said was their intensity and their effort, if you will. I don't know if he used the word effort, but, I mean, they just played so much harder in game three than they did in game two. But Miami took it to them in game two. They got all the loose balls. They just did they were the more aggressive team. Last night, I didn't think there was any question who the most aggressive team was. It was Denver, and they pounded them on the glass, and it seemed every time there was a 50-50 ball or something rolling on the floor, it was a Denver player that came up with it. So I thought that had more to do with it than any particular scheme that Miami used. I mean, Miami played well, don't get me wrong, but I don't, they'd have done the same thing again if it would have worked. I just think that Denver played a lot better than they did last night.
PJ, you gave us like 5 or 6 solid points there, but I'm going to latch on to one.
Sure.
It's not as simple, I assume. It's not as simple then going into game four for Miami to simply say, oh, well, we'll just try and make Jokic into a scorer again. Because as you said, part of the reason that worked is nobody else really got it going or going well enough in game two to really make that much of a difference. So I guess maybe I'm sort of repeating Jonesy's question to some degree. If you're Miami, what's the counterpunch then? What's the move that brings you back to hopefully even this series in game four?
Maybe they double him more. Like they've had some success doubling Jamal, getting the ball out of his hand. And there's a more than a few possessions where, like, he had 7 turnovers last night, I think. He holds onto the ball maybe one dribble too long, because the kind of the general rule of thumb in the league is you double Jamal when Nikola's on the bench. Because normally when you double Jamal and he throws the ball to Nikola, if he happens to be on the floor, the next pass is for a basket. I mean, he gets an assist. It becomes a hockey assist. I'll try and make this good for the Canadian audience. It becomes a hockey assist immediately. Like, Jamal gets rid of the ball, it goes to Nikola, and it's a 4-on-3, and he always finds you know, the guy who's most open or who can do the damage. They may even double Nikola a little bit, which is usually not a good thing for the same reason, but maybe when he has it up high, away from it, like they got torched a few times when they did it in game one. They didn't do it much, but that was because they had that bad mismatch. Kevin Love wasn't playing, and they had nobody to put on Aaron Gordon, and he just lit him up in that first quarter. I don't know what I'd do, to be honest with you. Like, I've really enjoyed watching. We were out west. We had Kesty and I had the west. So we were out there with George Sedano, and we got to watch them a lot, way more than we did in the regular season. My favorite thing about this series, even though it's only three games in, is that the rest of the country, and if not the world, I mean, obviously it's a big international audience too, in the NBA Finals, are seeing Jokic. And they're literally, there's so many people going, damn, I had no idea he was this good. He's been ridiculous. And it's almost like a coming out. I don't know how you can be a two-time MVP, and this is almost a coming out party. I cannot tell you how many phone calls or texts or people I've talked to all saying the same thing. I didn't think he was this good. I'm saying, like, are you kidding me? And how about Jamal Murray? Has never played in an All-Star game, and he hasn't been an NBA player, all-NBA player. Now, again, he missed it 2 years after the bubble with a horrendous injury that they weren't even sure he was going to come back from. But, I mean, like, how crazy is this? You got a two-time MVP that everybody's surprised is this good, and you got another guy who's never played on an NBA All-Star team, and arguably right now he's one of the best players in the league. So it's crazy. If you're not, on TV as much, and I'm telling you that, in Toronto, you know the same thing was said years back. I always forget what year who wins what year, but when Toronto won, you had the same thing. Man, I didn't know they were this good. It's unbelievable. Certain teams get all the ink and get all the exposure from us, and we're as much to blame as anybody. Like, we didn't have Denver on enough this year. I mean, I would think we're going to have them on a heck of a lot more next year, regardless of how this series ends up. But I don't think there's anything you can do with Jokic, really. I mean, you try different things. Mixing it up is the conventional, and it's the best thing just to give him different looks, because I think he sees the floor, and he's so big that he can throw over doubles anyhow. But he sees the floor as well as or better than anybody that plays. I mean, it's like Stockton or Magic or somebody like that. I mean, they just know where everybody is, and you double him or you make a mistake, they find the guy instantly. That's what he does. On top of that, he's unselfish. I mean, he really would prefer to pass than shoot the ball. And then you got a guy 7 foot and almost 300 pounds who makes threes, who can put the ball on the floor, who can shoot with either hand when he's in close, and he's on a good team. I mean, you got no shot. What would I do if I were coaching? I'd call Michael Malone and ask to be an assistant so I could play coach their team. I don't want to coach the other team.
PJ, it's funny because I know you used to be able to take advantage of him defensively, but Michael Malone's done a great job of hiding him. I'm watching pre-switches where, Jokic's guy is on the block and he's running up top to set a sprint screen, and Jokic just says, hey, one of you guys take him up here. I'm going to stay down on the block. Like, Michael Malone has done a good job of hiding him. And here's the thing that I guess I would ask you as a coach. You're Michael Malone. You saw the force they came at with the desperation in game two. You saw the desperation they had in game seven against Boston. They're playing for their season in game four at home in front of that crowd. There is going to be rabid desperation from the Heat. What do you talk to your team about? Because you know there's a big punch coming.
Well, he's going to show them just bits of either of those games. And I'm sure he's already talked about it. There's no question about that. And he's going to tell them, lace it up, guys, because you know what's coming, and you better be. Miami has proven to be this year the most resilient team, and the team that just has no – there's no conventional wisdom watching them. You watch the game last night, you go, to series is over. There's no way they can come back and win. Well, every time everybody said that against them, and the clearest example was clearly after game six. Everybody said, well, they had their chance. In their own building, they had their chance, and now they got to go back to Boston. What chance do they have there? They won by like 100. They're going to get that. There's no question. And Denver's going to have to – I thought – you hate to use words like that because it implies the team's not trying. It's not that. But I thought Miami outplayed Denver in game two. I thought they took it to them. They were the aggressor. They played with more force on both ends of the floor, especially on defense, but also on offense with their cuts, with their screens, with the way they took the ball to the basket. Last night, there's no doubt in my mind that Denver was the more aggressive team. And Friday night, that may very well determine. Well, you know, the even games, to me, it's always been kind of like game one, game three, and sometimes even game five. They're toss-ups. You throw the ball up, you see which team wins. And then game six, the team that is behind or four or two have such an advantage. The one that's down, you know, 1-0 or 2-1 or 3-2, they come out frothing at the mouth. And that's the first problem and oftentimes the biggest problem the other team has. Can you match the desperation level? And this is even heightened even more because, you know, you're on the verge of what they had in game seven, putting the uniforms away. And the thing about game seven, it's the same for both teams. But like these even-numbered games, it's not like that. So that's going to be probably Denver's biggest challenge. Can they match the desperation that I'm very confident Miami will bring to the table?
PJ, as a coach, how much would you have to fight the inner voice, perhaps, that you might be having? If you're Eric Spoelstra, if you're Mike Malone right now, you were talking earlier about some of the guys' struggles, you know, individuals on each side that have struggled at times in the opening three games. The voice that is maybe telling you, do I need to look deeper into the bench, or do I need to play this guy a little bit more? Do I need to cut the minutes back of a Strus who's not shooting the ball well, or a Porter, or just as opposed to trusting these are the guys that got me here, they're going to get out of their funk? Like, how do you have and how do you deal with that internal battle of that voice that's going on in your brain of what to do or not to do on a possession by possession or quarter by quarter basis?
Well, it's a great question, and I think you could learn from watching these two guys. Strus looked so out of sorts, I'm being polite, in game one, and they're on the road. And, you know, down 1-0 in the series, and it seemed like it was almost ready-made if Spo was going to make a move. Well, he makes a move, but the move, and it's funny, everybody still makes it like he brought Kevin Love out of mothballs. Kevin Love has started, I'm trying to look at a stat sheet, if they've played 20 games, he started 18 of the 20. He went back to the lineup that he was using and put Kevin in. The reason he put Kevin in the game wasn't Strus missing threes and the other guys who missed threes in game one. It was because they didn't have a matchup for Aaron Gordon. The one that everybody's talking about right now is what's Michael Malone going to do with Michael Porter Jr. I don't think he's going to touch KCP because KCP's a veteran. He's got too much of a track record. Michael Porter Jr. is a prime one, you would think. This is a young guy, even though he's been in the league 4 or 5 years, whatever it's been. It's a young – I know he played in the bubble, so, I mean, it's been a while. But it's a young guy. It's a guy who seems like his missed shots are also affecting his defense. He did rebound last night. He did a couple of good things. But it would seem like, why don't they put Christian Brown in the game, or why don't they start Bruce Brown? One of the colors, they have the color guys on the color, C-O-L-O-R, guys on the bench. You bring in Brown or Green. You know, why don't you bring one of them in? They've all played better than Michael Porter Jr. I just don't think he's going to do it. You look, A, they're ahead. B, he played 62 games in the regular season. Michael Porter Jr., he started every one. They've played, I think, 18 games so far in the playoffs. He started every one. Michael's just not going to go away from that. Now, again, you get down 3-1 if it's Spo, or, you know, you get to the point where you really feel you're back into a corner. Eric did not feel that after game one, and Strus rewarded him in that first quarter of game two. He made those four threes in the first quarter. Michael Porter, I keep waiting for him. The one thing everybody knows he can do is make shots. And I believe he's 3 for 19 right now in three games in the finals. But I don't see either of them pulling the plug on those guys.
PJ, we appreciate the time and the insight as always. And thanks for joining us multiple times throughout the season as well. I don't know if we'll get a chance to talk again before next season because we'll let you rest. We'll let you have some space, but we'll be bugging you again in the near future. All the best.
I'm
have a great summer.
I'm bummed out about Trattoria Giancarlo, but thank you guys. I appreciate it. Eric Jonesy, great.
All I can say is, all I can say, PJ, is if I'm in Vegas, I expect a glass of red and maybe the same limo driver that I had last time.
we got you covered, but it's not only going to be one glass, Jones. It's going to be multiple glasses. So, Lace up. Be ready.
I don't know if he can handle that, PJ. I don't know.
That's why I need the limo. That's why I need the limo driver, E.
Exactly. We'll get someone else to drive.
All right. Thanks, PJ. Always fun to chat with former NBA head coach, former Raptor assistant, longtime coach at the collegiate and professional level, broadcaster PJ Carlissimo. All right, we're going to step aside for a quick break. When we come back, more Smith and Jones as we will be joined by Randy Foy. Back on Smith and Jones, Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. Subscribe to Smith and Jones wherever you get your podcast. Download, subscribe, rate, review, and share. Thanks again to PJ Carlissimo for joining us to start the show this week. And we're pleased to bring into the conversation right now NBA veteran and a man who played alongside for at least a portion of his career, just for a little bit, but he played alongside Nikola Jokic in Jokic's rookie year. Former member of the Timberwolves and Wizards, Clippers, Jazz, Thunder, and Nets, Villanova product, Randy Foy. Randy, take me back to your couple of seasons in Denver, but specifically Jokic's rookie season, your chance to play with him, at least for a portion of that year. And I'm sure you've been asked this before, but we haven't heard the answer. What did you see then versus nearly a decade later now, the player he was versus the player he now is and the impact he's had on the league, let alone on this series and this final specifically?
To be honest with you, the person that I saw is the same human being, which is amazing. With all the accolades, all the money, dreams coming true, not only for himself but for his family, he's the same person, man. He's a character. He's a funny guy. That's why his name is Joker. But he's a hardworking dude, man. The basketball side, I saw it because I can remember we were playing the Spurs, and he was struggling a little bit. He wasn't playing as much, but he got in against the Spurs, and I think he had like a double-double. But I think he had double-digit assists. And if you remember those teams with Tim Duncan and Tony Parker, Manu, and Kawhi, for him to be able to do that against them when they were trying to stop him, I knew right then and there. I didn't know he was going to be this special. I would be lying to you if I said that. But I knew he was going to be really good when playing against the Spurs that way.
Randy, Denver made the trade, actually, and traded Yusuf Nurkic because Eric and I did the game and we thought, how are we going to keep these two cats straight? Jokic, Nurkic, they're both big European guys, look the same. I'm like, and they saw something and they made the trade. What did you see with both of them kind of competing with one another because they basically shared a spot? Is there something that had you say, you know what? Yeah, I would lean to Jokic over Nurkic.
At that time, we were calling Nurk. We was calling Big Nurk, which is Nurkic. We was calling him the Bosnian Beast, right? And Joker at that time was just more finesse. Like he did everything good. He didn't do anything great yet, but he just did everything good. You know, if he understood when, you know, he set a pick and roll and he was to roll to the basket and the defense collapsed, he understood that the shooters were on the weak side. You know, Nurkic was the type, if he came off a pick and roll and the defense was collapsed, he was going to try to dunk on everybody, charge, dunk, miss dunk, whatever the case may be. So I think, you know, you have to tip your hat to the front office. You know, I'm really close with Tim Connelly, and Tim Connelly was raving about both of them. And, you know, the question, or the hot topic was how we're going to pay both of these guys. We can't pay both of these guys, so we have to figure something out. And at that time, Nurkic was hotter, so you could probably get back more for him. But we understood, or not we, because it wasn't me, but they understood at the time that, you know, get more assets for Nurkic. He's going to be really good there, but let's continue to develop and allow Joker to be the face of the franchise.
It's just interesting to see how much he has evolved. And as I said in my initial question to you, just the impact that he's had on the league, let alone on Denver and the Nuggets. And, you know, Randy, I'm editorializing a little bit here, but we're seeing things from him that we haven't seen from many players in the history of the game, let alone from a man his size to be able to do what he does. And I would ask you as a guard, like, can you even come close to finding a comparison for what he does at his size with the way that he especially passes the ball, handles the ball, sees the floor, et cetera?
Yeah, I think the one thing is his work ethic, right? So the one thing that he works on, whatever he's weak at, he works at it. And I would see that all the time. You know, he would be in there, you know, hour and a half before practice lifting. Then he would work on his game an hour afterwards. And just he was always focused on the little things. And I thought that was, like, for a young player to be able to pick up on that early on in his rookie year, just working on the little things, I was like, whoever coached him overseas did a hell of a job, because he understood every single day he came in, he put his hard hat on, and he treated it like a job. It was blue collar, and he worked really hard. So from being in those rooms and those settings with him while we were working or we were watching film or we were just talking about basketball, it doesn't shock me, because his English is much better now. But even when he was, you know, kind of fighting through that barrier, he still understood every single thing that, you know, Brian Shaw and those guys were trying to, and Mike Malone and those guys were trying to teach him. Because you got to think, the terminology in European basketball is totally different from NBA. And he picked up on that stuff right away. But just his work ethic was just unbelievable, to answer your question.
Hey, Randy, you hit on something that I wanted to ask you. You talked about the bigger picture, whoever coached him. What are the international players doing that our North American kids aren't doing right now in terms of an understanding and a feel for the game? And I'll say this, you're a Philly guy, Randy. You're a Jersey guy.
Jersey.
You know what it's like to play Jersey. It went to school in Philly. Yeah, that's right. You know what? That's why I said Jersey, because Eddie Pinckney told me that. Big P told me that. Now,
yeah.
Now
it's all the
you
same,
guys
though.
Understand.
It's Connecticut to DC is all the same.
There it is. We might as well throw some New York in there, too. The issue is, when you're playing on the blacktop, everybody understands it's about winning. So you do what it is you have to do to win. If that means rebounding, set screens, making shots, play defense, whatever it is that the five guys you put on the floor on a Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock on the playground, it's about winning. Somewhere Jokic has been taught that. And I'm asking, is that more of an international thing now, where our North American kids want to put the ball between their legs and do it and get on the highlight reel, whereas some of the international kids are like, hey, man, and that we see that in Jokic. Hey, man, I don't care what happens, who gets the credit. I don't care if I'm scoring a bucket or setting a screen or pushing the ball up the court. I just want to win. Where are they developing that mentality, Randy, and we are falling down somewhat in North America?
That's an unbelievable question, because me and my friends and, you know, some of the guys I play with, even now with what I'm doing at Villanova University, it's our kids are not being taught. Like, we're being taught everything, to do everything fancy and to be creative. That's cool, right? But if you think of, you know, a step back or a side step, that only happens, you know, between 4 and 7 times a game when you can do that. But the little things, you know, like triple threat, passing the ball, dribbling the ball, you know, on time, on target when you're making passes, attention to detail, just understanding both sides of the ball, offense and defense. I think that, you know, these AAU coaches, and I came up through the system, but I had a strict coach that was a high school coach first. These AAU coaches are failing us, because these kids are running around and they're playing open gym. No one is teaching them. So when you get to college, you know, they like, oh, this guy's a one and done. If you look at this year, because I was around it, you look at a lot of guys that was supposed to be one and done. Guys, they slip through the cracks because they're not being taught the fundamental things, the little things that help you win, the little things when you're under pressure, how you move without the ball, how you set someone up for a screen, how you come off of a pick and roll and look for yourself first, but look in opposite and look for the roller. They're not being taught these things. And there's a lot of former players out there that can teach guys these things, but they're not being hired. So I think for me personally, just watching it, this is just a fundamental thing. I know for a fact in every single sport, when it comes from, let's just say from 11 to 17, that we're being felt, because it's all about winning and it's all about who can run fast and who can jump high. It's not about the small things. It's not being, you know, it's not about, like, guys need to learn. They need to be technical, which is handling the ball, making the right pass, understanding. I think the biggest thing is being coachable and understanding the little things. And we're being felt at this moment.
Eric, let me jump
in.
Funny,
here. Just as
Randy.
Yeah, go ahead, Jones. Go ahead.
I want to jump in just to piggyback on something Randy said. Randy, do you think the way Jokic is playing now might temper some of that? Like, in game three, he made a give-and-go pass that was, for a layup, that was something that you learn in grade school. And, you know, the old adage, well, if you want to get open, go set a screen. He sets a screen. And I'm telling you, like, we, Eric and I laugh about it all the time. The man can't jump over the Philadelphia Inquirer, but he is so effective. Do you think that his play will have people saying, you know, it's a copycat system. People will say, well, hey, I don't need to be athletic. This, like you said, it's great to have that, but maybe I need to play more like this cat.
Well, this kid is going to be the number one pick, right? He's from France, right? Don't forget the size, right? Because I saw him standing next to Rudy Gobert, and I played against Gobert, and I know how tall and how long his arms are. He's taller than him, but you see how this kid's dribbling the ball? You see his shot? You see his form? Mm-hmm. You see how he understands everything? He picks his spots. He gets to certain spots on the floor, right? And we're not talking about him being 7'5". We're talking about the little things. He understands. This kid's 19, and he understands the little things. Think about Giannis. Giannis was raw, but he understands the little things. Think about Luka Doncic. Think about all of these guys, right? It's already happening. Some of the top 10 best players in our league, five of them are from Europe. So if, you know, we don't wake up and smell the coffee, in 2 or 3 years, 10 of them are going to be from Europe because they're coming. And I think a lot of times, like, AAU coaches, they don't get it. They just want to put the team together. They don't want to work hard. They don't want to put the guys through practice. They don't want to say no. And they're looking at these guys and they're not saying no and they're not pushing them. And the kids are basically running the teams. And so when you get on the court and something doesn't go their way, you're not going to be able to coach them because you never coach them in practice. Everything starts in practice.
Randy, I guess this veers off the topic a little bit, but it's on the topic we're discussing. And I'm finding it very interesting. So I want to follow this path a little bit. You think it's because it's become too much of a business? It's not about the kids anymore. It's not about the development. Maybe not with everybody, but on large, is it too much of a racket now, too much of a business where there's so much money to be made that kids are just becoming numbers and dollar signs and not individuals to mold any longer?
That's another great question. Kids are not allowed to develop, right? They're on social media. Everyone's telling them they're great, right? And if someone's telling them they're not great, they can swipe across and hit delete. But I can remember playing. I can remember going up against guys and getting my butt kicked. And the one thing that I wanted to do, I just wanted to get back to the playground the next day to prove myself. And I would get my butt kicked over and over and over. I remember when Alvin Williams would come back. I remember when Kerry Kittles, Jason Lawson, you know, Jameer Nelson, Allen Iverson, they used to come play with us in the summertime. Lou Will. And they used to bring it, and I used to bring it every day. And it wasn't enough to go against Allen Iverson. It wasn't enough to go against Kerry. But those guys were really good NBA players. But every single thing they did, I watched. I would watch Allen Iverson. Yes, the crossover was great, right? But the footwork, right? I think kids are crowned nowadays too early because of social media. They crown these kids at 9 years old. And this kid is living a life like LeBron James from, let's just say, 13 to 18. So he already reached the mountaintop. So the kid gets there, and he's in college, or he's a rookie in the league. He think he already made it. But that's when the real work starts. When you get to college or you make it to the league, that's when the real work starts. And whichever one comes first, you got to start over. You get to high school. I mean, you get to college, you start over. You get to the pros, you start over. You're a rookie. And I think guys are crowned too early. I think we're missing 3 to 4 steps of development that the European guys, they're not missing it. They're making sure these guys are going to school. They got practice in the morning. They got practice in the afternoon. And they just repetition. They just continue to repeat it. We don't have that. We have open gym. We have TikTok. We have all this other stuff. And that's it. You know, a lot of guys, you see a lot of guys running around. They're projected to be, you know, these top picks or these best players that's coming out of high school. A lot of them can't even, you know, dribble with their right hand, can't dribble with their left hand. So it's like we're missing a ton of steps. And I like it. Like you said, I know we're off topic, but this is something that, you know, just watching it and being around it, this is something that had bothered me for so long. And I'm glad I'm able to have this conversation with you guys to get it off my chest.
Randy, you get in line, man, because I have been beating this drum. And I'm telling you, it's why a lot of the old school coaches won't coach anymore, because a lot of the kids are saying, hey, I ain't listening to you. Could you imagine being at Villanova and you didn't like what Jay Wright was doing? Like, hey, man, I'm going in the transfer portal. I'm out of here. No, your dad would say, no, you get yourself back in there. And you listen to what that man is telling you. We don't have that anymore, Randy. And I totally agree with you. And for me, I want to know when our kids, and maybe it's just a maturity thing, when our kids are going to wake up and say, hey, man, these guys are kicking our backside. And I will tell you this, as somebody who's on the board here of basketball, the Canadian Basketball Board, we're focused on development. And our under 16, our under 17, all these teams, like, we're into the fundamentals and the development, because in the end, that's what has you. I mean, look at Kyle at 37 years old, still playing, because he's playing with the little things. He's playing with his head. He's in position. You know, people bristle, oh, Villanova, they make you jump stop. That's right, because that way you don't charge. You don't give the ball away. These are the little things.
I couldn't agree with you more.
I couldn't agree with you.
So I appreciate that. In the summertime at Nova, we would do this thing that was called jab series. And we had one dribble. So we would basically play 1v1, me versus Cal, me versus Alan Ray, me versus Mike Nardi, Biggs in there. And you had a jab series where you got to jab and go, you know, jab to the left and go. And you had one dribble, but it was all you had to get to the basket. And that's why when I got to the NBA, we used to do stuff in the pick and roll, and I used to manipulate the pick and roll because it was what I learned in college. And I can remember doing this stuff, and I used to look at Kyle, and I used to be like, man, why does dude have us doing this? Like, this is so boring. But then I'm 30 years old in the NBA, and I'm using it to get open, and I'm knocking down shots. And then I'll go back to going over to the banquet in the summertime, and I'll say, Coach, thank you, man. I appreciate you. He's like, what are you thanking me for? I'm like, just thank you. But I'm thanking him to be a basketball player.
Great story. It's a great story. We're talking with Randy Foy. Randy, we've been talking so much about Jokic and memories of him. But let me ask you, guard to guard, what are your impressions of what you've seen, not just in this series, but over the last few years with the development and the rise of Jamal Murray? Speaking of, you know, like, I know Canada, we get lumped in with the U.S., with North America, with the development, but we're talking about two of the better young guards in the game right now in Jamal Murray and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, coming from north of the border, and Murray specifically, what he's been doing in these finals. I mean, if it weren't for Jokic doing his thing, Murray would be, you know, heads and tails, you know, a lock for the finals MVP at this point with the numbers he's putting up. Again, what's your impressions of what you've seen from him and his development as a guard in this league, especially battling back from injury too?
You know, I love Jamal Murray's game. You know, I look at Jamal Murray and I love guards that can shoot. I just think that opens everything up for you. I think when you can shoot the ball from anywhere on the floor, you can do whatever. And, you know, he's athletic enough to finish at the rim. He's tall enough where a little guard can't handle him. And he's tall enough where if they put a bigger guy on him, he can, you know, make quick moves and step backs and pull up. You know, Jamal Murray, 6'4", right? But he plays, that dude plays like he's 6'7", 6'8", man. And I just think that his game is, you know, exactly like if I had someone and I was in a, and I'm training a kid and I'm working with a kid, you know, that would be that's Jamal Murray's right up my alley. You know, his handle is, you know, I wouldn't say it's, you know, below average or average, but it's right above average. His shot is off the charts, right? His athleticism is right there. Not like a young Russell Westbrook, but good enough. But I just think his game is just next level. I think that he has a game that sets him up for longevity. He can play one. He can play two. He's going to be able to play two when he get older. I just think that his game is just – it's just what an NBA guard is supposed to look like.
Hey, Randy, loved having you on the show. Loved the conversation, and we would love to get you back sometime down the road as well. Thanks for doing this, and enjoy the rest of the series.
Anytime, man. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
That was longtime NBA vet Randy Foy, and that's going to do it for this edition of Smith and Jones. Again, we will keep the show rolling right through to the end of the NBA Finals and right up until the start of free agency in the NBA, so we'll be with you on draft night as well. Again, a couple of shows left until we maybe take a bit of a pause for the summertime, but subscribe to Smith and Jones wherever you get your podcasts. You can always stay up on the latest right there on Google, Apple, Spotify, or otherwise. Download, subscribe, rate, review, and share Smith and Jones right here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.